Well, first of all, welcome to Weekend America, Dan.
Thank you.
Give us an idea of what the climbing environment was at the altitude where you encountered Lincoln Hall.
Well, you know, we ran into him at 7:30 in the morning on the 26th of May. The sun was just rising. It was a beautiful sunny day. There was no wind, no clouds. We were just 2 or 3 hours from the summit, so it was right there. We could almost reach out and touch it.
And you were with a couple of paying clients and other mountaineers?
I was with, there were four people in our little group. There was Jongbu Sherpa from Nepal, Andrew Brash from Calgary, Canada, Miles Osborne from Warsash, England, and myself.
So you were with three other people, two paying clients. When did you see and identify this climber, Lincoln Hall?
Well, we came around a corner, and we were just topping the ridge. The sun was just rising, and I saw a bit of yellow fabric in the distance on the ridge top, kind of, you know, I thought it might have been a tent or something. I had no idea that it would be a person, and as I got closer, I saw the most bizarre sight, this gentleman sitting up, kind of cross-legged on a 2x2 flat spot on this knife-edge ridge on his left. He could have fallen off about 8,000 feet. On his right, he could have fallen off about 6,000 feet. And he was sitting there with no hat on and no gloves. His down suit was, he had removed down to his waist, taken his arms out of his down suit. He had a thin sort of fleece shirt on, and that was unzipped, and he kept putting his hand inside his jacket. He looked very disturbed. He was kind of jerking his head around, trying to focus on things. His face was extremely pale. His hair was very messy, and he looked very upset.
What did you do next after you saw him?
I was kind of in a state of shock. I hadn't expected to see a live person up there. And so I walked up to him, and I was staring at him, trying to take it all in. And, you know, like I said, I was in a state of shock. And he was kind of looking over at me and then jerking his head away and looking out into the distance, trying to focus on something on the horizon. Then he looked back at me. And I must have really looked shocked because he said something to me. He said in a very kind of gruff and hoarse voice, he said, "I imagine you're surprised to see me here."
What went through your mind?
I didn't know what to say. My first thought was that, wow, this guy is, you know, he looks really bad, but he's able to speak, and he still has his sense of humor. He had a kind of dry Australian wit. I could tell right away this was kind of a witty Australian thing to say. And so I thought about it for a second, and I said, yes, I'm really surprised to see you here. And then I thought about what I should say next. I wanted to kind of, you know, make conversation with this person. So I said, can you please tell me how you got here? And he thought about it for a while and kind of looked out into the horizon and kept looking back at me. I think he was trying to figure out if I was part of a hallucination that he was having or if I was really there on the ridge with him. He'd been there all night long with no oxygen, so he was very delirious. And when I asked him the question if he knew how he had gotten there, he thought about it, and he said, "No, I don't know how I got here." And then I thought to myself, well, you know, this conversation isn't going very well. And I tried to think of another question that he might be able to answer, so I said, can you tell me your name? And he thought about it for a while, and then he seemed suddenly to be very pleased with himself, and he said, "Yes, I do know my name. My name is Lincoln Hall." And then there was another silence, and I was thinking, okay, you were making some progress here. And after a moment of silence, he said, can you please tell me how I got here? And I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't.
Now, I imagine you're thinking about how to help this guy. He obviously needs help immediately.
Well, the first thing that we did was I opened my rucksack, and I had an extra oxygen set with me, a mask and a bottle of oxygen and a regulator. So I got that out and set that up immediately and put the oxygen mask on him. I could tell from how pale he was and the color of his hands. He was holding his hands up. He had no gloves on, and his fingers looked kind of like candlesticks or something, and they were just sticking straight out. He couldn't move them because they were frozen solid. So I knew he needed oxygen right away. And then I proceeded to help him zip up his, put his jacket back on, put his down suit back on and zip it up, and find his gloves. We found his gloves laying on the ground, and we found his hat, put his hat back on. All of which he immediately started taking off again. So we put an oxygen mask and gloves and a hat on him, and he took all that off. And then I'd say, no, it's cold up here. You know, your hands are frozen. You need to put your gloves back on. It's really cold. Let's keep your jacket zipped up.
Why do you think he was doing that, opening his jacket and taking his gloves off?
I don't know, but I knew a fellow climber who passed away in 1996 on Everest. His name was Scott Fisher. And I'd been on some other expeditions with him. And when he died, he was found, he had stripped off a lot of his clothing. So apparently this is not a unique occurrence, that when someone gets really cold and perhaps hypothermic and starts hallucinating up at altitudes, you know, like where we found Lincoln Hall at 28,000 feet, the mind can play crazy tricks. Maybe they suddenly feel warm, or the constriction of the clothing. He kind of reminded me of, at this point, when we found him, he kind of reminded me of a three-year-old. You know, mm-hmm. the way a three-year-old will keep undressing themselves, mm-hmm. and you'll be like, oh, you need to put your clothes back on, or can you please keep your shoes on here? And they take them off. The next thing you know, you look away, and they're taking off all their clothes. So he seemed a bit he was functioning at that sort of age level.
Daniel, did it occur to you not to approach this guy?
No, it never did. Him? I mean, it never did. It never did. You know, obviously, you know, he needed help. He was sitting up. He was pretty alert. He was very deluded. And we couldn't believe the way we found him. You know, he had no backpack, no oxygen, no food, no water, no mattress, no sleeping bag. He wasn't even tied to the rope. And we found him right at dawn, and he's sitting up and sort of, you know, trying to talk to us. We just started helping him right away. There was no thought of not helping this person. He obviously was in deep trouble, and at that kind of altitude, there's not a lot of time to sort of think about, oh, what should I do and what should we do? And, you know, we just jumped in there and started helping him right away. There wasn't any time to think about what to do.
Well, as you well know, just a few days before this, there was an Australian climber in similarly bad shape, and dozens of climbers passed this guy up on their way to the summit, and the man died. So these people chose not to help someone, a fellow climber. What do you make of that?
Well, you're speaking of David Sharp, who
yes.
apparently died several days before we found Lincoln Hall. You know, I wasn't there, so I can't really say exactly what happened. Apparently, in the early hours of the David Sharp episode, it may have been possible to easily rescue him. He was lower down on the mountain than Lincoln Hall. So to me, it seems like it would have been possible, you know, with a concerted effort of, you know, four or six people, you could have sort of slid him down. He was probably only an hour or so above the high camp. And I'm not sure. I believe some people passed him at that early stage, and I'm not sure why they didn't help him. It could have been that maybe they thought other people would help him. Maybe they felt they weren't qualified or weren't prepared to help him. You know, it bears further examination. I believe that David Sharp lasted for quite a number of hours up there, and his condition deteriorated so that he was sort of, you know, frozen solid and couldn't move around and could barely speak. And, you know, at that point, it would have been more difficult to rescue him. Another thing about David Sharp was that he had no team. He was a solo climber, and he had no support. He had no Sherpas. He had no radio, no walkie-talkie. So, you know, there wasn't really anybody who was responsible for him.
Daniel, I saw you quoted as saying, "I hope we rescued a nice guy, and it turned out he is a nice guy." What difference did it make whether he was nice or not?
Well, I'm glad that you asked that because, you know, when we finally got back down to the base camp like 3 or 4 days later and Lincoln Hall was still there, he was kind of recuperating in a tent on oxygen, and it was time for us to go and meet him. Well, we actually hadn't gotten to know him very well up there at 28,000 feet. You know, he was, you know, saying some bizarre things like, you know, apparently during the whole time he thought he was on a boat ride. Things like that. So we didn't really get to know much about Lincoln Hall. So it was time to go meet him down in the base camp. And so we were kind of nervous. You know, like, what is this guy going to be like? Is he going to be a nice person? You know, like, we were saying, we really hope we rescued a nice person.
Yeah. But what if he'd have turned out to be a jerk to you with a family who loves him?
I know, exactly. You know, I mean, so... we were very nervous, and then we went in the tent, and he woke up, and he talked to us, and he was very polite, and he was very soft-spoken, kindly person. He said thank you, and then Andrew started asking him about his family, and it turns out he has a couple kids, and he started talking about his family and what his life is like back at home, and he turned out to be a really nice guy, so we felt relieved.
And would his life have? Would you have valued his life any differently if he had been an obnoxious jerk to you?
No. And also, other people have asked, you know, if you had found someone up there who was sort of, you know, half frozen and only able to mumble and blink one eye, would you have also, you know, put so much effort into it?
Yeah, instead of uttering an impressive witticism.
Yeah. Of course we would have. Of course we would have. You know, it's, I mean, the guy was right on the trail. He was right there. All we had to do was, you know, get him to put his clothes back on and put an oxygen mask on him and try to give him some food and water and try to find out who this person was and what team he came from and how we can get some help up there. Of course we would have helped, no matter what. You know, I mean, that's the way I was raised. You know, when you see someone who needs help, you do what you can, you know?
Well, since we're talking about valuing human life, Daniel, some people would look at you, at a mountaineer, and question how much you value your own life.
Well, that's a good point. And, you know, I'll have to say thank you to, you know, my girlfriend and my family and all my friends and the people out there who support me and going to the mountains and going to Everest. I mean, it is a dangerous undertaking. It is risky. You do what you can to minimize the risk and to try to stay away from disasters and to be really cautious. Someone asked me if I have fear, if I'm afraid of dying, and I'd have to say that I don't think of it as fear. I think of it as respect. I feel like I have respect, because if you're afraid, you might be nervous and you might not be able to be as alert as you should. So I have respect. I try to look around at the mountain, at the weather, at the people I'm with and my team and the other teams. And hey, if you know things don't look right, if the weather's bad or if there's a lot of snow and there might be an avalanche or if the people in our team seem like they're not doing well or there's other people that need help, you know, You have to know when to say no and when to turn around. And the mountain is always going to be there. I think that's the lesson, you know. Our lives are short, and we're just here for a little while. And you know, when you're out there with these big mountains with glaciers and the weather and things, you know, that is a kind of permanent situation, you know, that's ongoing. And we have to kind of maximize our stay here and value it.
So those climbers who didn't help a fellow climber in trouble, do you think you value your own life any less than they value theirs?
Oh, I don't know. I think that your question about the values is really right on. You've hit the nail on the head. I mean, obviously, they have different values. And sure, we all value getting to the top. You know, like I said, it's such a task to prepare for going to Everest. But, you know, yeah, I think you have to be careful to kind of weigh the different values that are out there and the different options and really have your priorities in order. And what is the most important thing? Is it your own glory or the glory of your team? Or is it trying to do as good of a job as you can while you're here on the planet and help others? You know, it's a question of values.
I think I heard you answer your own question. How is Lincoln Hall doing?
I saw Lincoln Hall yesterday together with his wife, Barbara, and he was very pleased to be on the planet. I can tell you that. And his wife, Barbara, was really glad to have him around.
How healthy
and
is he? What kind of ill effects did he suffer?
He's got really bad frostbite of his two hands and one of his feet. And I didn't see his hands. They were swaddled in bandages. But I did see his feet when Barbara changed one of his bandages. And looks to me like he's going to lose some of his toes and therefore definitely some of his fingers.
Well, Daniel Mazur, I really appreciate your talking to us.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.